Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Family Forever Child's Conversation in Care podcast. My name is Amanda Griffith, and I'm the CEO of Family Forever Child. This podcast is a space where we can talk directly to practitioners about how they are providing care to vulnerable children and families around the world. And these organisations have a wealth of knowledge and experience from years of working with children and communities to develop solutions to improve children's care. Today's podcast is the second of three episodes on the topic of integration and reintegration of children on the move. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Shash Owihori Iyaiya, who is the country director at Usenga Nyamanzi in Rwanda in sub-Saharan Africa. Usenga Nyamanzi, or I'll call it Usenga for short, was established in 2002 in response to the high number of children and young adults who became orphans and heads of their households as a result of the Rwandan genocide and the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Usenga's aim is to build the resilience of children, facilitate their reintegration into society, and to promote their rights in families and communities. In Rwanda in 2020, almost 3,000 children were living on the streets as a consequence of family poverty, the death of parents, the need for income to survive, engaging in petty crime, and mistreatment at home. Street-connected children are regularly exposed to physical and sexual violence, and levels of drug use are high. Usenga believes that if children are to develop and participate in society to the fullest of their abilities, they must be protected in the home and the community. They must be supported to interact with children and adults, and they must benefit from organized early childhood development, education, and care. I'm looking forward to learning more about the work of Usenga is doing to support these vulnerable children and families. So Shast, welcome, and thank you very much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you, Amanda.
Shast, first of all, just to give some context in this particularly complicated and difficult times, could you start by telling us a little bit about the situation in Rwanda in terms of the COVID pandemic? Are there any emerging trends? Is it starting to have impact in your communities?
What I can tell you, Amanda, the COVID situation has been a hard time in Rwanda. That was, I can say, a situation started in March 2020, where we got the first case of COVID in Rwanda. But before, of course, we were just following news worldwide, hearing that COVID situation is expanding. And so we're waiting with a lot of fear. So when Rwanda, the Rwanda Biomedical Center announced that we had the first case, I can say it was a trouble, a lot of fear. And we went in a totally lockdown. Everything closed, businesses, schools, and so we're staying at home with a lot of confusion, a lot of fear. So that was a little bit challenging for everyone and for everybody. And specifically for the work we're doing, supporting families and children, it was also not easy because most of the work we do is face-to-face. And we're not used to do online activities. We're not used to those training, those psychosocial and psychological support face-to-face. So it was a challenge. And specifically for the children on the move, and mainly street children, you know, everywhere in the world, the street children, they are living from, they survive from restaurants, from businesses, from activities in the cities, in the street, and everything were closed. So most of them, they stayed there without anything. So that was the first challenge we had. We had really to find, if I can say, innovative solution to work in that situation. And what I can say really, what was needed, it was emergency activities and which can work in that situation. So the COVID really impacted.
And the situation at the moment, have you, because there must be some concern about the new South African strain, which seems to be much more virulent. Are there concerns that that's going to come across to Rwanda in time?
And the process, since that totally locked down, I think it took almost 3 months where some activities started to reopen progressively, and from a little bit June, July up to January to recently, the things were a little bit normal because everything were normal, and recently the situation became again challenging because the number of cases increased very quickly, and the people who are dying now in Rwanda are increasing very quickly, and we are going a little bit back to lockdown. It's almost the same situation at the March last year, where people are facing a lot of fear. But what different? In March last year, it was one case, and now almost everybody knows who died because of COVID, and that's a little bit how I can say now it's worse than last year.
And of course, Shas, this is building on a country that has faced significant challenges already. What with in 1994, the Rwandan genocide, and then the impact of the epidemic of HIV and AIDS. There's already extensive vulnerabilities within Rwandan society. And I know that the Rwandan government has always been very much at the forefront of social change and with child welfare reform, has for many years been committed to family care and introducing family care. So just for the listeners, what's the context in which you're working now in terms of child welfare reform and how that's impacting on children living on the streets in terms of what the government responses are?
As you said, coming from a genocide history where almost 1 million died just in 100 days, where the genocide happened in every village in Rwanda. People died everywhere in Rwanda. And the situation which created so many orphans, so many widows, and after genocide, there was a lot of trauma cases and emotional cases and psychological problems in Rwanda. If I can say the recent research done by the Minister of Health in Rwanda, the National Mental Health Survey, we found that almost 12% of the general population they suffer from major depression. So that's a little bit hard. That's a research done in 2018, where when we are going to the population of survivors of genocide, 35% they suffer from major depression. So you see that the context of mental health problems, and there is also the intergenerational trauma, the second generation, the children we are supporting, also the HIV AIDS. When you see in 2002, they were a lot of challenges. People died from HIV/AIDS, and the situation people just after genocide, they go for unprotected sex, and the HIV increased a lot. But as you said, the government of Rwanda really did a lot, and it comes really the government alive at the point where they stopped the increasing. Nowadays, I cannot say that the HIV, of course, it's still a challenge, but really, it's only 3% of the general population which are HIV positive. So the COVID situation, which came in that context of psychological sufferings, so really increased a lot of worries, a lot of anxieties, a lot of, there is even some, I remember when the first day of COVID, there are so many people who were comparing that situation as a war, as a second genocide, which is coming. That is really how it was not easy. And then all those situations, during the COVID, they increased a lot children to go back to street. That's how I can say, Amanda.
Okay. So in that really challenging context, Shast, can you tell me a little bit more about how USENGI actually works with street-connected children and their families in practice?
UNM, when it has been created in 2002, the main purpose was just to support orphans, heads of households, survivors of genocide. That was the primary objective of the organization. At that time, the children, they were separated each from another. You because those children who were left, who were funded by genocide, you could find like a family of four brothers and sisters. One is living in an orphan in one family, another is in an orphan, another is in another family. And the objective, the methodology, the way it was again to bring together and to recreate again a family. Because those families, they were a little bit destroyed. And the Uisenga, and we started a little bit to trace those children from different families, even foster families, and to trace them from orphans, and then to create again a family. That was a little bit the model of Uisenga. We breed houses and what we called children village in Rwanda, and then we create again families. And of course, there is a lot of support in terms of psychological and psychosocial support, economic empowerment, education, so that really those kind of children, they can come back to the normal life. It was recently, I think 2014-15, where we started this street children reintegration program. Comes from our previous experience in supporting those children, heads of households, and reintegrating back to community and to families. Even a little bit before working with street children, we have been part of this care reform in Rwanda, where we were pressing children from orphans to families, either to extended families, to kinship care, to foster families, and we have been leading that process of preparing parents, preparing children, creating again the linkages between children and the parents and the families, and then and now I can say that the process ended. Now we no longer have any orphans in Rwanda. Then in 2015, where we said, is it really the process of reintegrating and supporting children from street? Is it the process, the model, the way the things are being done are being really well done? And it was also in the period where the Family for Every Child were launching the reintegration guidelines. So we have even a little bit inspired by the reintegration guidelines, and we have been trained on those guidelines, and then from that background, we said, how can we really adapt something and develop something which can really more good in reintegrating street children? Because normally in Rwanda, the street children were, if I can say, escaped from street by police, and they were placed in what we call in Rwanda transit centers, and before going to rehabilitation centers, to what we call rehabilitation centers, where they can pass even almost 2 years, even more, before being placed in families. And so we come up of a model, but also the parents, they need support. I remember when I was discussing with one official from here in Rwanda, and I told to her that a child leave a family because there is a problem. And I was just comparing that there is a fire in his family. And he tried to leave that family because there is a fire. He arrived in the street, he find a fire. And then he go to transit center. And we try, and then to rehabilitation center, we try to heal him and to support him. And we bring back that child again in a fire. Because nothing have been done just to stop that fire. That was a metaphor I used just to show that we need, of course, to support children, but we need to support families before bringing together children and parents. So we developed that model where we tried the program where we supported parents, baby, for a period of almost 3 months. Just we developed a model of psychosocial and psychological support, where parents, they go through it's almost 7 sessions. The parents pass through. The first session is a session we call responsabilization, to support, to care their role, their replacement. Nobody can replace a mom, nobody can replace a father. So that's the first session. And then the second session is a session we call a little bit naming a problem, trying to identify what's a problem. It should be a psychological problem. It should be a social problem. It should be a relationship or couple relationship problem. So that's a session where we try to identify together with our parents what's really a problem. And the following session is a healing session, where now we try to find a solution. And if it's a psychological problem, now the parents should go to healing, and we link them to counselor, to psychologists. And if it's a social, we find a social work to work with them. And if it's an economic or a relationship, so we go to healing session. After healing session, there is a session which is being done together with kids, which is a session called breeding relationship and attachment session. You know, Amanda, when children left families for 1 year or 2 years, there is a challenge in terms of attachment. The children, they are really, if I can say, there is a problem between, if I can say, emotional attachment between parents, between families and child and children. So there is some exercise we created, just tried again to, if I can say, to breed again those emotional relationship between parents and children. And then the next session is a session we call the breeding ambition and confidence, because most of the time when children left families and they go to street, sometimes parents, they feel sometimes incapable to follow their children. And sometimes they accuse children. They say those children, they are bad boys, they are bad girls, and we cannot really support them. They use drugs, girls and boys we can support. So we breed that confidence and ambition that they are even the only ones to support them. Not we sing as a center, but the children, and finally we do what we call a belonging group. You know, Amanda, all of us, we do belong. That's how we support community structures. We do belong. If we don't belong, I think you will die. And that is even sometimes one of the lacking activity which was being done by some institution. When they bring back the student, they connect a child from a street, but they don't connect a child to the community. They don't create a belonging, because the belonging group, the group of street children. So if they don't find where they belong, they go back to the street. So that to find the belonging, that's the final step for parents. And for the children, it's almost the same. Apart the first session, we don't do for them, we don't do a session of responsabilization. But we start by naming problem, healing, breeding attachment, breeding confidence, ambition, and then we find belonging to them, which are the group of children in the community. That's how really we started, and after and I think even we tested that process, and thank you to family, because the family support that testing process. And after testing that process, it showed that it was a good way. And even some other civil society organization, including SOS, government institution, they have been requested to be trained and to be supported. And it has been a little bit adopted as a model of now, which is a little bit being used in Rwanda, because now children when they're in the street, they are no longer go to transit center. They are supported and the family is supported, and they go back immediately to families. That's a little bit. I talked a lot. I don't know if it's making sense.
That's really helpful, Shastin, and to see the different steps that one has to go through, and how it sounds to me like your approach is both systemic, in that you don't just look at the child, but you look at the system, the family system in which the child is going to be placed, and but also that you look at an holistic approach, in that it's looking at the psychosocial issues, it's looking at education, it's looking at the economic, and recognizing also that in both being systemic and being holistic, that you need to be individual, that each individual's case needs to have its own specific responses and understanding. So, and then so that your steps enable you to do, to think in a systemic way, think in a holistic way, but then also think in an individual child and family way. Do you think that would reflect your sort of...
Yes, Amanda, that's reflective, because we do support individual, and even I forgot to say that when we start, we do what we call individual support plan for both children and parents, but we do also a family support plan, but also a community support plan. And we say, for example, this child should go to the work with a psychologist, work with them, but also we need to see how will be the integrated part of family and working with their parents and their extended families. And we try also to see how he will be reintegrated in the community, how he will be, we will find a belonging group for him. So those are three elements: individual, family, and community support plans.
And so if we look at that community aspect, Shast, because as you say, the danger is that both parents and actually society blames the child, and the child becomes the sort of deficit model. It's the child's fault that they're on the street. But you're turning around that completely and saying, no, we need to look at, we need to support the child. We also need to look at the family dynamics to see what needs to change there. But importantly, there's also something here within communities and with structurally that is leading to these. So can you talk to me a bit more about the work you do with the sort of wider issues of why children are on the streets, what's happening in communities, or what's structurally happening, where the challenges are that you need to, within society, which is resistant to change, and how you've had to address those in communities?
In the community, what do we do? First of all, we do collaborate with local authorities. Okay. And in Rwanda, there is, if I can say, a system created, which is called Inshuti z'Umuryango, Friends of Family. Those are the two people, a man and a lady, who are elected by the community just to follow the children with difficulties and the families with difficulties. So we do work with those existing community structures at the village level. And then also we create parents structures, mainly where we it's a parents group. Those are the groups of parents, in where we include those parents who have the former street children, and they elect a committee, and then they propose a working plan which is include different activities, including how they care their children. So how we care and how they care, we do decentralization to community. But also they can include activities like income generation activities, the relationship activities, etc. And we create also a group of local authorities which just have to receive a report of those, a group of parents and a group of children. I forgot that we create also the belonging group I talked about. Those are groups of kids, of children, that they have to work and to, those including the, if I can say, the leisure activities that they play, but also they can also discuss and reflect on challenges of children in their community, in their villages, in their families. And they have also to report to the local community and to parents group what challenges and what problem and what the activities. And from that structures we do in the community, that is we call, that's what we create, we call joint monitoring and evaluation system in the community, community joint monitoring and evaluation, because most of the time we think that monitoring and evaluation is being done by software, by whatever, by our professionals, but the community itself, I forget even to talk about schools, even at school level, we create structures, because if a child has been reintegrated in the family and in the schools, and today is not going to schools, a teacher has to call a parent. A parent has to call to inform to local authorities. The local authorities sometimes have to inform us. So that joint monitoring and evaluation in the community and the joint, if I can say, intervention in the community, because I like my professional staff. It should be something which can be done by a teacher at school level. It should be done something which can be done by parents or by neighbor parents at a community level. So that's something we establish in the community, and we, for us, we are drivers, we are facilitators, we are not doing, and the community itself is doing this process, and we facilitate that process. That's how I can say the activity we do in the community, Armanda.
That's really very thoughtful and shows how comprehensive it is, the work that you've developed. Can you just, what are the challenges that you faced in implementing this, Shasta? What are the pushbacks or areas of resistance that you found in particular that you say that you've really realized that you've got to address that before you can have a successful long-term reintegration program?
I cannot say resistance, but one of the challenge is that we find some individuals who have been deeply affected by the situation, sometimes psychologically affected, and even sometimes they need some medication, they need even psychiatric services. Sometimes if a child passed like 5 years in the street using drugs, it's not easy for the community just and for us just to heal in 3 months. You know, Amanda, addiction is one of the challenges, which is not really. So that's one, even for the parents, there are some who sometimes they are addicted and with drugs, with alcohol, they need, if I can say, a professional support, a specific support, and the long-time support. That's one of the challenge, and sometimes we don't have if I can say, the professional and the specific setting specialized for those kind of support. That's one of the challenge. And the other challenge is what sometimes I would like to call complexity of problems. Complexity of problems, because that sometimes when I like to say, when we are in front of complexity of problems, you have to find the complexity of solution. You may go to a family, you find there is a legal problem, there is a poverty, there is a psychological problem, there is a handicap, a child with a handicap, there is a complexity of problems, and sometimes you don't have this interdisciplinarity services just to provide. That's, and you need sometimes to partner with maybe a government, you need to partner with another institution, and sometimes those institutions, they don't understand the model and the way you are working, and sometimes they think it's if I can say you need a magic solution, just quick solution, and when you say it's a process, you have to wait, and so that's another challenge. And another challenge, it's the understanding of two children at different levels. I little bit talked about parents who think children are bad boys. Even you go at school level. I remember when I am integrating some children back to schools, some teachers say that they are afraid of receiving those children at school. They think those are they cannot be good boys at school. They will steal. They will beat others. Understanding. So we need a little bit awareness and training. Say that that's a process. So if a school fails to reintegrate the child back to schools, meaning that a child will go back to street, it's not only parents. If we go to I remember one time I reintegrated a child in a classroom, and some student told me that a teacher told to children, say, no, you have to be careful. Don't listen to him. He's a bad kid. He's coming from the street. So that's a big challenge of understanding of and finally, I can say that even a challenge of resources. That's a program that need resources. When I'm saying resources, it's not only money. It's even human resources who have capacity and skills and tools, because even in most of the capacity and tools, I have already started to develop tools and exercise in Kinyarwanda and the local context. But you will find, Amanda, most of the tools, they have been developed outside, and they are in English, they are in international languages, and it's not easy even to adapt them. We need resources, tools to be created in our context, using our way of behaving, our ways of working. Not only those, you will find so many forms developed from elsewhere, saying those are the assessing forms and checklists and whatever. So we need contextualized and localized tools, and sometimes we don't have. And of course, even financials.
because in a way you've shown that, exactly as you said, the needs are complex, the context is complex, and therefore the solution needs to be complex. And it's things like, as you say, the issue of addiction, the issue of social norms and perceptions, the issues of sort of discrimination and prejudice that happens. And then the absolutely imperative is that anybody using the tools and resources that are context specific, that really understand that specific environment and are able to operate in that way that is relevant, rather than something that's come from outside that doesn't resonate with the situation and the needs and the actual problems and the potential solutions need to be very context relevant and rooted, which is really helpful. And just starting to think forward in terms of this, where are you thinking maybe future developments for your program? Because as you say, this is now a program that's very well developed. It's very methodical. It's very clearly clear to articulate the different aspects of it. And it's starting to get really good take up within Rwanda with large organizations like SOS keen to learn how to do it. Where are you seeing the future for the program in terms of where you hope to, the next stage you're hoping to take it to?
We are now thinking, really documenting well, right, the program. Even developing tools and materials, as I was talking about, but also sharing those models. I wanted to say sharing, but sharing and. When I'm talking about sharing, for example, here in Rwanda, we have already started to train even some government institutions, some government officials, some NGOs. So we need a little bit, if I can say, to more see how we can influence everybody here in Rwanda so that they can see street children as the normal children as the others, and that they can be supported and be reintegrated. And, and we are really proud that even the government, at central level, a little bit approved that way of working. But also, Even within the family, we had already started to talk about YALED in Ethiopia. Even before COVID, the group visited our program. They visit families, and we facilitate some session together. And the YALED said that we can go there and support them. And even in Zimbabwe, even in the government of Zimbabwe, when I went there and explained how they had requested just to come here and to learn and to see how we are supporting children. So we would like, of course, a little bit to make it really happen in one, but also to support others. It doesn't mean that, as I said, that the program has to be contextualized. It doesn't mean they can use exactly what we are doing, but they can be inspired and develop something really which is adapted and contextualized in their context, but which is a little bit holistic, as you are saying, because most of people, they think the children, they are the children who have problem, but no. The children, they are leaving their families because in the families they are a problem, because in the community they are a problem. So that they can really find this holistic and integrated approach in their respective areas of working. So we need really, first of all, to document and having the document guiding people. And then And even publish, we would like even publishing some document. That's what we want to do.
So as you say, the developments now are starting to go beyond borders, in that the principles of the way in which you work are things that you feel that others, like Ethiopia and like Zimbabwe and potentially other countries, can reflect on those principles and then say, how would those principles apply in my context? Which I think is a very powerful sort of way of driving forward, learning from each other's experience, but recognizing that you then need to embed it into your own local context. And the other side of this, Shasta, I'm reflecting, is that much of what you're talking about is actually also really good practice in terms of prevention. And I think that often people see reintegration, but they don't see the other side of the coin, which is that obviously really, really positive reintegration is addressing the very causes of the separation. And so if you address those causes, the separation may not happen. So it is a preventative approach, which is so important, because the damage that happens from family separation and the investment that's needed to reintegrate a child back into the family, if one could actually have interventions in advance of that happening, so much less harm is caused both to the child, the family, and the community. So I don't know to what extent you see that also your work is about a prevention model.
Amanda, I think these issues of working with families and children, sometimes you cannot separate an intervention to another intervention. You cannot prevent without caring. You cannot caring without preventing. And sometimes prevention, rehabilitation, reintegration go together. When you are, if I can say, you are rehabilitating a family, because for us, reintegration, it's not reintegrating children, you're reintegrating also a family, and you reintegrate also parents. So when you are reintegrating parents, you are preventing their children to go to street. So they go together. And what we need is just to identify what are the specific activities which goes to this and to that. But sometimes the wording, preventing, caring, reintegrating, sometimes, of course, those are the concept which are, but those are the interlinked concept, and every program need another program to be successful. That's how we do. For example, when we are setting those community structures and the system just to maintain the reintegrated children to the community, we are doing prevention. And we are doing the prevention for other children, but also we are creating the caring environment in a community. So that's how I can say. So if possible, all those programs can go together and see how specifically each can complement another.
It's a strengthening process, isn't it? It's and therefore strengthening is about both prevention and successful reintegration. So my last sort of question to you, to thing to explore with you a little bit more, is you've been a fantastic member of Family for Every Child, with made great investments into growing the network. And I wondered at this moment, for you, in terms of the challenges of COVID, whether you reflecting that that being part of an international alliance, how that's helping you or could potentially help you in addressing the specific challenges you face at the moment in this very difficult times?
Amanda, even before COVID, let me be started before COVID. I like to say that this really family, this alliance, it has been always an inspiring framework, just inspiring, and we have been inspired in different ways, in different program we developed since 2013, when we started being part of family, and we initiated so many programs and so many, we developed so many tools and materials just to support. I remember even in psychologically, when we have been supported in narrative therapy, and so we have really been inspired and developed so many programs. And specifically during this COVID, being part of the alliance, first of all, as I said, when the COVID situation started, people have had fear, even if they have fear, including ourselves, including the organization. I remember when the lockdown started, and we had the last meeting before going to our families, you could see all staff, they had worries. What will happen? And I think the family, starting with secretariat, you organized this online sharing, and we have been in comfort. We have been comforted by this family. Things are moving forward. So we're thinking that maybe things have stopped, and maybe the word is stopped, and now the family, they email us, what is happening, what the situation, how can we support, there is emergency fund, there is, so all those communication, and we have been comforted. And the working groups, they continue working online, participating in meetings, and I can say that, and even from that perspective, is the way now UNM played a role, a big role during COVID, and we created emergency centers. Even if now they have been closed because children they went back to community, and we have even supported financially by the alliance, and I cannot say that not only the money, but mainly, how can I say, that way of being together, that way of sharing, really, I can say, being family member increased a lot. Now the image of UNM during this COVID, now the during this COVID, the image of you, we saying guys, we are becoming expert in even in intervening in the emergencies. We had never intervened in the emergencies, but we tried. So we are very proud. We are very happy. We are learning because of being a family.
Thank you for that. And you have been a key founding member of family. So this is your creation as part of a broader group to make it. As always, Shas, this has been a really rich and insightful conversation. Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing again about all of your work and the methodologies that you've developed, and sharing so openly about Husenga Nyamanzi, how it's responding to the needs of vulnerable children and families and your support. And I think the sort of, for me, the sort of key takeaways have been that the importance of attachment and rebuilding of those bonds within the family and within the community. The importance to think at the individual level, but also to think holistically and also to think in a systemic way. And that necessitates one looking at the child. What I think is so inspiring is that you're speaking from a country that has experienced the most incredible shocks through time, with the genocide, with HIV and AIDS, and now, as you say, the impact of COVID. And yet what you're able to demonstrate as a local civil society organisation. And thank you to those of you who've joined us to listen to this conversation on CARE, our podcast, and to learn more about Usenge Nyamanji's work, as well as the other members involved in How We Care series. You can sign up to receive alerts of new podcasts and other activities, and you can visit www.howwecare.community. We hope you will join us next time. Thank you very much, and goodbye.